try and get these talks to be something which is useful and just something which relates to our life, our world. And what I wanted to talk about this evening is something which I call authenticity. Because, you know, there's so many people who pretend to be one thing and know there's something different. And, you know, whether in religion that really destroys people's faith, you know, in sort of religious people. They're supposed to be kind, they're supposed to be compassionate, but they ain't. We find out. Or whether it's, you know, in politics or in other people of authority. And that takes a lot of the important confidence which we have, you know, in people we trust in our world. And I was always told when I was a kid that if you get lost, I was born in London, 1951, if you get lost, you can ask a copper, ask a bobby, and they'll always tell you, you know, just kindly, just, you know, how to get home without swearing. I'd say where to go, and it didn't mean that way, they'd always be trustworthy and helpful, which is wonderful. And I remember some of those stories about policemen. You weren't afraid of them, they were just there to assist and help, and because of that, you know, that people would help them. And I remember my father helping the policeman once, but in a way I never really anticipated. Because this was... I told so many stories, I think this was 2 weeks ago, I hope not. But I told this in Singapore, that I was about a six-year-old kid. And a six-year-old boy, you know, just, you know, loves doing silly things like answering the door. So as soon as the doorbell rang, I ran to the door to answer, and you know what I saw outside the door? Two big British policemen outside. And they said, "Can we see your father?" I said, "Yeah, he's in the front room of the house. He's there." So off they went in there. And then I didn't think much about that until when the doorbell rang again, and I ran to the door, another two policemen were outside. "Can I see your father?" "Yeah, he's in there." Another couple of minutes, the doorbell rang again, and another two policemen were outside. "Can we see your father?" "Yeah, he's in with four other policemen." And at this point, I was only 6 years of age, but I started to get worried. What has my father done that is six policemen, you know, are talking to him? And then another bell came, another two policemen. It was about a dozen policemen in the end interviewing my father, I thought, my father is not a terrorist. Actually, didn't know what a terrorist was in those days. But anyway, he's not a bad person. What are all these policemen doing? And I started to get worried. And I went in the room, "Please don't take my daddy away. He's a good daddy." And then I realized why so many policemen were in the room talking to him. Actually, they weren't talking to him. The noise was coming from the TV, an old black and white TV, because it was the English soccer FA Cup final. And my father knew one of those policemen and said, "Well, you know you're supposed to be protecting the streets, but you know you can come to my house instead and watch the soccer." And one policeman told the other policeman, told the other policeman. I had a dozen policemen there. Instead of protecting the people of London, they were in my father's front room watching the soccer. But as a little kid, you got afraid of that. But anyway, you know, I realized it was nothing untoward. But, you know, that is, you know, sometimes just how you feel, you know, to be an authentic person. But at least my father was, you know, pretty authentic. You know, he knew exactly who he was, what he did. And he was a very kind man. But also, at the same time that I told that story over in England, sometimes that we could trust the policemen in those days. We can trust even religious people. But why is it that we're losing that trust today? Is because the most important part, you know, of a relationship, whether it's with your partner in life or with, you know, sort of teachers at school, or, you know, doctors, leaders in communities. For the very least, we should actually, you know, just to walk the talk, as they said. I remember the occasion once where, try and be as kind as you possibly can. And I was in Singapore some years ago, And there's one person, they used to look after me. It was the Buddhist Library in Singapore, for those of you who know that organization. And that, you know, they were looking after me, but, you know, and then I got involved with the Buddhist Fellowship. You know, it's just another group. We try and always help out each other. You know, if Buddhist monks and nuns, if we can't sort of heal wounds and create sort of harmony in this world, and sometimes you ask, what am I doing this? You should try and promote as much harmony and peace and goodwill as you possibly can. So when I heard that this monk who'd ran this Buddhist library, who I hadn't seen for a couple of years, you know, was actually having a fundraising jog, you know, down the Esplanade in Singapore to raise funds for his temple, and I found I had a free afternoon, which was actually quite rare, I said, many of the disciples in the Buddhist Fellowship said, let's come and help. We should help one another. And so they all came along. They're a bit concerned about me doing a jog. But it doesn't matter. So I went there, you know, to raise a bit of funds for a fellow organization. And at the same time, there was a politician there who was also going to sort of, you know, support this fundraiser. And so, because I was well known, that, you know, I was very welcomed, but then I had to give a talk, first of all. And I don't know why it is, but I'm always having to open my mouth wherever I go. So, you know, I talk a lot. But it's one thing which I've noticed as you get older, you know, you get invited to talk more, because this is a great truth I noticed many years ago. That when, you know, the older you get, you know, your eyes go, you have to wear glasses, and sometimes your legs are not as strong as they used to be. You know, sometimes you have to, you know, be helped getting up or use walking sticks. You know, sometimes even your hands get a bit shaky, get a bit weak. There's in your ears, sometimes you can't hear properly, sometimes you can't remember everything. As you get older, there's many parts of your body starts to decay and get weaker and weaker and weaker. But I've noticed as you get older, there's one part of your body gets stronger with age. This, the mouth. Old people can really talk. They can't hear what other people are saying and they can't see very clearly, but they can certainly talk. Have you ever noticed that? I've noticed that. That's why usually politicians, they can't really do well as a politician until they get old. And they can talk for hours. Anyway, so I'm getting old now, so I can sort of start talking a bit longer. And anyway, so this politician, I came up first of all, and I said that, no, I'm very, very happy to come and support this, but I'm not just supporting it, I'm going on the jog as well, you know. And they said, oh, you don't, you know, you're a monk, you only have to go halfway. I said, no, I'm going all the way. You know, that's what I always say, that whatever you do in life, if you're going to do it, give it everything you've got. Don't just do it half-heartedly. So I went up there and said, yeah, and as soon as we finished here, you know, I'm going to go on the walk as well. And then the politician came up, and I knew this politician, said, I hope you're going to go on the walk as well. And he looked at me and said, no, I'm too busy. So I couldn't resist the opportunity. I say, here's a good example. Someone in politics, he's going to now sort of give a nice speech to celebrate the walk, but he's not going to go on the walk. He's talking the walk. Well, they should be walking the talk. So anyway, I know he laughed at that. He always reminds me of that. You know, he's a politician. Yeah, I don't walk the talk, I talk the walk. So anyway, that you have to be like real authentic in this world to actually to get really people to understand you and be open to everybody. That is why that, you know, it's a bit of a problem for me sometimes, that where I live is in a cave, a real cave. And I let people go and have a look in it so they can actually check it out. Yeah, I do live in a cave. However, that sometimes, yeah, you know, I like to stay in the cave, I like to meditate in there. I still remember once after a big ceremony, I was really tired, and I went to my cave to do some meditation myself. You know what was happening there? There's one of the people. They were sitting in my cave without permission. I said, no, no, come on. I want to stay in my cave as well. It's my bedroom. It's my meditation room. I often say I'm the only person, not just monk, whose bedroom is a tourist attraction. So people come and look at it. But anyway, that at least people actually see that this is how you live. And it's real. You do live simply. Same as, you know, this, my bag. This bag is also my suitcase. So this afternoon when I came back from Singapore on Singapore Airlines, first one out, simply because I didn't have to wait by the baggage carousel to have all this other stuff coming up. And nowadays it's very, they know me there at the airport now. There's not that many monks, there's not many people actually come out like me and just with a bag. They used to ask me, sir, you've forgotten your baggage. I said, no, this is my baggage. I remember this customs officer once, you know, asked me, he said, well, you know, why have you got so little? And I said, because I'm a monk. And as soon as I said that, I'm a monk, they got it straight away. And they said, oh, well done. To see, you know, someone who's a monk and practices like one, only got a few possessions, which is amazing that, you know, people actually do this these days. I just like when I still haven't got this seniors card. I applied for a Commonwealth seniors card, you know, to get a bit more respect. No, I don't know why I did that, but, you know, they sent me the information, said I should do it, so off I did and did it. But the problem was, I had to go off to the Centrelink in Armidale, you know, just because, you know, they could just fill out the forms. And they said, you have to have proof of identity. I always remember that one. That was a really difficult one for me. Proof of identity. Because they said, okay, show us your bank statement. I haven't got a bank account. Credit card. No, I haven't got a credit card. Okay, your rental agreement or your home loan or your, you know, the house which you own. I don't own anything. Oh, crikey. Wedding certificate will do. I'm not waiting for you. Your driving license. I haven't got a car. And I went through all this list of IDs. I said, how can you prove who you are? And Mr. Bumawangso, they called me Mr. I said, actually, that's a very good question. I've been trying to find out who I really am for the last 43 years. That's why I became a monk. You know, they didn't see the funny side of that. But in the end, I managed to sort of get something or other. So just managed to get the number of points to prove who you are. It's really weird, isn't it? You know, you've got to prove who you are these days, and it's really difficult for a Buddhist monk to prove who they are. But I was very proud of that in the sense that it's great. You don't have all these things. You know, you really are a monk. Because what is a monk or a nun? I think a monk or a nun is someone who lives simply. And that is really just, I think, what human beings, especially, you know, if you are into even like saving the environment, having a small footprint. This is one of the reasons why at least we can have few possessions and we share what we have, which is quite a nice thing to be able to do. So, at least you can be authentic. And you know that even celibacy, I have been celibate for 43 years, and a bit more. And people say, oh, come on. I said, no, honest, absolutely honest. I said, that's impossible. You must be really weird. Well, sometimes I accept that. But I said, well, you know, don't you miss girls? And I said, not really. How come? And a lot of times it was because that when you meditate, or when you actually live a nice, peaceful life, yeah, you do lose some things, but you gain other things. And with other things you gain, it's this great ability, you know, to actually to get into some nice, deep meditation. Really peaceful, very blissful. And that was, okay, I'm just telling these stories. And it's, you know, it's absolutely true. used to have many girlfriends when I was a young man, and there was one girlfriend, you know, which was, you know, having, you know, sexual relations with. And then I went to a meditation retreat, and the bliss which I got in meditation was way, way better, honestly. That's all I can put it, okay? So I knew what I was giving up for something much better. And so it's amazing what you can do in meditation when there's something even deeper than the sensory pleasures. It's not that you just give it up because you're trying to torture yourself. You know, there's sometimes in religion they do it like abstinence, like, what is it called? Not tormenting the flesh, but whatever it's called. They have this stupid idea, you know, of like just being really cruel to the body in order to become holy. And you know me many times, you're not cruel to your body. You know, I make sure I'm reasonably healthy, especially around here. And actually just around there. But you have a lot of happiness and fun, you know, without needing, you know, to get involved with those sexual relationships. And so, you know, we are, you know, pretty good monks over in Bodhinyana Monastery, and excellent nuns at Dharmasara, and you're not sort of uptight about these things. In fact, it's really weird in many cases that some of the things which I get up to, you know, some good things. I remember just one evening there was a fellow who used to work for this 6PR and radio station. You know, it was over in East Perth. And I'd known him a while, and he said, Ajahn Brahm, you know, it'd be wonderful if you come on one of the radio shows, one of the talkback shows. If you come on the talkback shows, you know, it gives another perspective to all these problems which people ask, and they sort of call up, and, you know, the old professors and stuff, we've done that before, but this will give something interesting. So, yeah, sure. So it was actually one Friday night, the only time I could really do it, Friday night, after the talk here, we got driven into East Perth to the radio studios to do a live talkback show on 6PR between 10 PM and 12, midnight. And the problem was, sometimes that I should really find out what I'm really doing. Because, you know what happened? Oh, I remember this time, late. So I just managed to get into the studio, rushed into the studio, just as they were going on air. And so they put these headphones on you, and you're just that far away from the microphone, the red light sort of starts, you know, behave, because this is live to air. And they never had chance to really explain the pronunciation of my name. Ajahn Brahma Wangso Mahatero, or something like that. Now that was just not gonna fly at all. So very quickly I just wrote down, okay, call me Mr. Monk. So that became my name on the radio show, Mr. Monk. And then they said, very honored today, they always say nice things about you at the beginning of the radio show, very honored to have Mr. Monk, the abbot of Bodhinyana Monastery, a Buddhist monk for so many years, and the other guest this evening, I always remember her name, Dr. Gabriel Morrissey, who's written many best-selling books on sex. And of that I did a double take. Uh-oh, what show am I on? The Buddhist monk. And it was on, you know, intimate matters. And they wanted a monk who'd been celibate for about that time, about 30 years. You know, but you know, that I'm never intimidated about anything. I answer questions on anything, even though I don't know anything about it. I still answer questions about it. It just got this wonderful, like, adventurous sort of spirit, and just, let's give it a try, see what happens. You know, people are so afraid these days. They never actually go outside their comfort zone. So yeah, okay, let's see what happens. And you know what happened? That after the first couple of questions, they could actually choose who they would ask their question from, whether, you know, the expert, Dr. Gabriel Morrissey, or just the celibate one who doesn't know much about sex, Ajahn Brahm, or Mr. Monk. And it was weird, because after about 5 minutes, every question was coming to me. Somehow or other, I gave more meaningful answers. which was actually started to make me understand that sometimes, you know, when you live outside the box, you can think outside the box. You can see outside the box. Sometimes we're so close and we think we know, but when you actually stand back, which is, you know, what a monk does, actually you can understand a much better picture. Sometimes you're too close to the nose. And when you actually stand back, you get some really good understanding. And that's one of the reasons, you know, just why, you know, we have things like monks and why you go on retreats, why you can actually leave the world for a week to have a nice, peaceful, serene time. And just, you don't think about the problems, you just separate yourself from the problems in a sense. So when you actually come out afterwards and you go back home, you actually get these beautiful perspectives which you hadn't had before. And see things from a different way. Now that is actually what I thought was real insight and one of the reasons why, you know, we have these retreat centers, we have these monasteries where people can come and stay for a little while. They have a place, you know, where you can just recharge and actually to see things in a much more different way. And it's also, you know, the fact that, you know, when you take away even like, please excuse me, competition, you know, for who's the most attractive, who's the most popular, blah, 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 who's the best earner, you know, who's got the greatest earning potential, who is the best person to, you know, to bring up kids or whatever. You know, when all of that measurement comes away, it's really nice being a Buddhist monk. Because, you know, you don't, please excuse me, but I don't see women anymore. I don't see men. I see people. So somebody was going to ask me this, Ajahn Brahm, are you a feminist? And yeah, even though it supports so many causes and just put myself on the line for, you know, equity, you know, just for especially females and also for gays, lesbians, transgenders. But I'm not a socialist or a revolutionary or progressive. I don't see it that way. It's just, you're kind. End of the problem. You know, you're fair. You know, why should you discriminate against anybody? Of course, no reason to. I can't see it myself. Maybe it's because I lived outside the box such a long time that, you know, you do think outside the box. So that, you know, just non-discrimination, just make sure everyone is treated fairly no matter who they are. And, you know, it's wonderful. Then you don't actually discriminate against people who are sick. Just because they're sick doesn't they're a person. I often say the story that there was this Tibetan Buddhist nun, and she was in a hospice over in the old hospice in Shenton Park. I can't resist saying this, but you know, it's a really great shame that that hospice was closed down. Hospices are wonderful places, you know, where we can die with some dignity and some care, just special places. But anyway, so I went to visit her a couple of times, and what happened was she phoned me, you know, an urgent call over at Serpentine, and she asked, please, can you come and see me immediately? Well, I'm really busy monk. And she said, I'm dying. She said, next 24 hours I'll be gone. And you know, this has happened so often. You know, the doctor doesn't know, but the person knows. And she was, you know, dead within 24 hours. But it's a long way from Serpentine over to Shenton Park, in those days anyway, the freeway didn't go even half the way. And so when I went to there, I had to check in first of all. You know, you just can't barge into the rooms because these are really sick people. So I checked at the desk, and there was a nurse there, and she was, the only way to describe her, you know, is this, and she must have been really stressed out in her job, was the nursing equivalent to Margaret Thatcher. She was a real tough nurse. So when I went in to check in, I said, I've come to see this Buddhist nun. And she looked at me, tried to really stare me down. I am sorry, but she's having no visitors today. But you know, I may look like soft and taken advantage of. But you know, when if I were to stand up for something, I will really stand up for it. I won't be moved. I could be a tough cookie sometimes. And so I said, look, she called me sort of just an hour ago. Says it's urgent. And she said, I don't care about if it's urgent or not. She's given explicit instructions that no visitors. But I've come about an hour and a half. And she got really angry at me. She looked at me and said, come over here. So I followed her. I don't succumb to fear. You know, you can shout, whatever. But I followed her and see where she was going. And it was to the door of this nun's room. And on the door, in her own handwriting, the nun's handwriting, an Australian nun, she had written, just on a piece of A4 paper, absolutely, absolutely no visitors. And the nurse, with a lot of glee, pointed to that and said to me, looked in my eyes, see? I always remember this. But I also remember that I looked carefully. I didn't have glasses in those days, much better eyesight. And then I saw at the bottom, you know, the small print which he'd written there. And what it said was, honestly, accept Ajahn Brahm. And it wasn't a compassionate thing. It's not really a Buddhist thing to do, but I just couldn't resist it. See? And she went off in a huff and let me go in. Well, I always remember that, but it wasn't because of just defeating this tyrant nurse, but it was the fact that when I went in there, I just asked her, why did you put that message on there? And why me? Why was I the only one allowed in there? You know what she said to me? The reason I tell the story is because you're the only person who comes into this room and treats me like a person, not like someone who's sick and dying. I remember what she said then. And I'd share that because if you go and see someone in hospital, then treat them as someone who is a person. The doctors will look after the illnesses. And she said, look, just chat to me about jokes, anything. So I don't know if I talk, no, I won't tell those silly old jokes about the person who went to the oncologist and said, he said, well, how long have I got to live? He said, only 10. I said, 10 what? 10 months, 10 weeks. And the doctor continued, 9, 8, 7, 6. It's an old joke. I don't mind telling jokes like that to people who are dying, make them laugh. And actually, they usually live longer when they laugh. But anyway, telling some jokes, just treating her like it was just meeting a friend in a coffee shop. Because imagine, put yourself in that position. You're someone who's really sick and dying. You know what you're dying, but you just want to spend the last hours you have just enjoying one another's company. Yeah, teach a bit of Buddhism, but you don't just talk about emotional stuff when a person, they're just fed up with all these people coming to see them. Oh, it's terrible to see you like this. Oh, it's so sad. Oh, come on. You know, that people deal with their illnesses by themselves. I was actually thinking outside the box, seeing outside the box, which was really interesting. And it's because you can do things like that, that's sometimes just why. You know, the authenticity which you have, and also the courage, what you actually see, how you feel, to actually say that, do that. You know, push it a little bit forward, because sometimes we get stuck. We get stuck in the old ways of doing things. This is why even religion should not be dogmatic. Not just following the old ways of doing things, but follow the heart of it, where it all comes from. Kindness, compassion, wisdom. So we can actually see things in a different way, a good way, out of kindness, out of letting go, and understanding something, which is that things aren't important. The best things in life are not things. They're relationships. It's a relationship you have. Because I learned this in science. I never really understood it at first. Like in science, it's not the stuff. Yeah, Higgs boson, electrons, whatever, I don't care, you know, what they say, because there's no such thing as a fundamental particle, basically. It's not the particles. No particle exists by itself. It's how it interacts with others. It's the interactions, the relationship which these things, particles, make with something else. That is most important. It's not people, it's communities. No, there's no such thing as an individual human being. It's how we interact, how we relate to one another. That is most important. Even myself, when I just go into my cave, it's how I relate to myself. You know, I have a relationship to myself. I'm kind to myself. Weird, but actually I love myself. People say, actually, how can you love yourself? You get proud. That is not what love is. Oh, this story came to mind because when I was in Thailand, we used to wander around place to place, and you know, I met some of the, a Venerable Munisara, a bhikkhuni over in Dhammasara. Sort of, I went to the little compound where she lived because there's the old Dr. Sanat, a very wonderful man, but you know, he was head of the Bank of Thailand when I first met him. He actually signed his name on the bills in Thailand. But it just happened. When I was doing my wandering from monastery to monastery, I kept on bumping into him. You know, not by any arrangements. I was at one monastery, and there he was, and he could speak good English. You know, obviously highly educated. And then I went to another monastery, and there he was again. Another monastery, and there he was again. So, you know, after a while, we started talking to one another, and still, you know, regard him as a really nice friend, really nice character. Just someone that's very easy you can, you know, spend some time with. And so it's wonderful, actually. You know, it's being a bit nostalgic, all these old times we used to, you know, have together, but that was really important. Not the people, not the status, but just how we related together. Even his mum's not here today, his daughter-in-law. And she was one of the people who used to come over to the old Magnolia Street when I first came here, years and years and years ago. And, you know, mother was Thai, father was Italian. She was like stuck between two communities. But the Buddhist center was her home. And so it was her family. So when she saw me over there, just wonderful, just how are things going on, who's doing what. And these are your relationships you built up. There was a girl over here who just, I didn't recognize her, but she said she used to come to this temple when she was really young. And she never really meditated or learned any Dharma. She used to play around, run around the place, but she felt so safe. And she came up and said, thank you. You know, I just had to come back and just visit the old place again. Had such happy memories. She didn't learn Dhamma, Four Noble Truths and that sort of stuff. Didn't know how to meditate, but she felt welcome and happy here. She learned the sense of being loved. And that is, you know, some of the essential part of the Dhamma. She felt welcome. So you know that sometimes you realize that, you know, what you say here, it's just not so much even what you say, but how you say it, where it comes from. The relationships you build up with people, the kindness, the safety. And anyway, that when I was over there, I was talking about, here we go again, this really old monk who was like the real monk's monk. You know, the one who looked, smelt, just breathed like a fully enlightened being. And I remember just going up to him with all my questions and all my doubts. Had to wait because he was very popular. That was Ajahn Tate. Died a long time ago. A beautiful monk. And when I went up to see him, all these questions like you have, the doubts, wondering about meditation, reincarnation, you know, just the meaning of life, all of that sort of stuff. But you know, like many people have those questions, but weird experience, as soon as you go into the presence of somebody like that, all the questions vanished. You got so calm, so peaceful, so still, that there was no questions left. Really. It was a weird experience. You realize, because what you felt was a total acceptance. The relationship, you know, which he had, this great monk with a stupid young English monk at the time, just still literally wet behind the ears, and many other places too, and just listening to him and feeling him, there was something which was conveyed there, which was this wonderful, beautiful acceptance, peace, happiness, beyond words. Didn't need the words to describe it. You have the thing in itself. Why do you need the words for, or the books, when you can actually feel this total peace and acceptance? I always remember that. It was just what he showed me. And that was something which was very important, which, you know, you learn that relationship, that kindness, because that's what you remember, all the words. Sometimes you forget the words, especially as you go old. But you never forget the feelings, just the kindness. All the time, whenever I go to funeral ceremonies, it's always the case that people don't talk about events as much as the beautiful times they share together. And I mention that because that's actually good, because probably this came from, I imagine, Cherry Jackson, because, you know, she usually does it. Where is she? Okay. But I just noticed behind here, no one actually told me this, but she's got a really good memory. This was my mother. It's the 6th anniversary of her passing away, her death. So thank you, Cherry, for putting up there. And when I look up there, this is a wombat, which she's got on her lap over here. Because you may know from one of the stories in one of my books, when I went to visit her first time from Australia, that, what can you, I don't have any money, but somebody over here kindly said, anything you want for your mum. And I said, well, a nice little toy, fluffy kangaroo, soft toy. Because a kangaroo, she would take it and she would remember that's from her son over in Australia. You know, Australia kangaroo, okay, it's kitsch, whatever it's called anyway, you know, everyone does it, but it really meant a lot to her. So I gave it to her, and she put it on the shelf. I can't see the shelf over here. This is a little council flat, the other side had a little shelf. She put it on that shelf. And so the next time I came over there, it became almost like a tradition. Next time I brought a koala bear, and next time was a kookaburra. The next time it was a platypus. And this time was a wombat. Trying to get, you know, soft toys. And she had this all on her shelf. Even the old kangaroo was on there. And this wombat, you know, stuffed wombat, was really big. And she just could not fit it onto her shelf. And I told her, Mum, why don't you just get rid of some of the other ones? Now give it to a church, give it to a charity. So then you can just put the wombat on there. And you know what she said? No. Every one of those reminds me of you. They've got such happy memories. I just want to keep them all. But you know what fell off? It was all the bills. They fell off. And that wasn't so bad. Let the bills fall off and keep the beautiful happiness there. And so that's, you know, eventually she managed to get everything on there, but I said, look, why didn't you take a few off? Keep life simple. But for her, what she really wanted was to keep the happy memories. And of course, that's, you know, seeing my mum here, that's the beautiful happy memories. That's actually what we keep. That's what never gets taken away. That's when somebody passes away, and that, you know, we keep those happy memories. That's what never gets taken away from you. So this is actually something when, what is the purpose of this life? What do you get left with? What do people remember you with? And it's just that kindness. And when I was over in Bangkok in one of these places. Oh, apparently the stairs were really slippy just coming off from the stage where you gave your talk. And people said, oh no, we've got to help you come down. I jump up. It's really, really slippy. And I said, look, you don't have to worry. He said, no, you may break a leg. I said, no, don't worry about breaking a leg. There'll be many people here, and take this the right way, would be very happy if I break a leg in Bangkok. Because that means, number one, they can keep me there another week or two. And number two, there's all these doctors here. They'll be fighting to look after me. I'm going to look after them. No, I'm going to look after them. Because it reminds me of the story of this American monk who went to visit Chicago, and he actually did fall on the ice and broke his leg. And he told me afterwards that he was taken to a hospital and, you know, put a plaster cast on in those days. And then the message came to his mother, your son has broken his legs, his 91 legs, sorry. And as soon as his mother came into the ward and saw his son, who usually was in Thailand, you know, immobilized with a huge cast on his leg, he said, my mother smiled. I've never seen her so happy in years. I said, Mum, why are you so happy? I've broken my leg. Yes, son, now I can keep you exactly where I want for the next 2 or 3 weeks, and I can mother you. Because she missed mothering her son. And that's an interesting story there. You know, why? You know, it's because, you know, that kindness, that beautiful idea of having someone to look after and being looked after. There's something really important in that, you know, even more important than many other things. So that sort of that relationship, that kindness, that is sometimes the authenticity of life. It's not who's better and who's wiser, it's who's kinder. And they have this beautiful saying in the Dhamma in Buddhism, oh, it doesn't matter who's the best or who's the worst. Who's the best? Who's the worst? There's no best, there's no worst. And sometimes people say, oh, we're all the same. No, you're not. If you're all the same, life would be just so boring. If all the monks, the nuns who sat here and gave talks, gave exactly the same talk, there would be there's so many different types of monks and nuns, and everyone is welcome. It's beautiful. And laymen, laywomen, just, it's beautiful. Don't ever try and be better, because that just puts so much pressure on you, actually, to achieve, to set goals and be the best. That's one of the big sicknesses of our modern world. Trying so hard to improve and be better. Because if you don't, you know, you've got to reach your goals. What was that? There's a woman here, I forget who she was, but, you know, good on her, she was really wise. Actually, she was afterwards, I think. But anyway, that she came up to me, said her problem in life. She put it very beautifully. That's why I really respect her. I thought she was very wise. This is where I know I should be in life. This is where I currently am. He said, you know, it's just so hard. So hard. I know this is where, you know, I deserve to be. Now, this is my earning potential. This is what I can do in life. This is what I know I should be. But I'm up here, down here, and I just can't get up there. There's so much suffering. And the solution was very obvious once you put it that way, in something which is very visualized. If this is where you are, and this is where you need to be, how about lowering where you need to be to where you are, then you'll find to be so peaceful. You know, that goes against the grain. We'll say, no, you've got to strive. You've got to strive for excellence. And I say, no, strive for mediocrity. The middle way of Buddhism. Where you are, how about that's where you want to be? That's called Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now. How about just enjoying where you are? When you want to be somewhere else, you can't enjoy where you already are. So wonderful. Just be. And now you come across this amazing realization. This is what I learned from Ajahn Tate. You're good enough. Isn't that nice? I'm good enough. So you can fly off to your little island and just relax and just be. No, nothing to live up to. No tests. No feedback from others. No even feedback from yourself. Just relax and be at ease. Whoever you are. And so eventually that little island meditation, you bring that inside your heart so you can relax where you are, whatever happens. So, this is learning how to find a nice relationship with yourself and with life. Not trying to be someone you can never be, but be authentic. Be who you are. You belong. All sorts of different people. You know, you're all very welcome. Hopefully that's why we don't have an admissions policy. We don't check people who you are before you come into this joint. Sometimes I say we're so desperate that anyone can come in. We're not desperate at all. It's just beautiful, open. And that's also all the monks and nuns which we have here. Sometimes what's the entry requirement to become a monk or a nun? Breathing. As long as you come in breathing, you can Now if you fit in, if you want to be there, and it just usually happens, people come and they just, you know, obviously that this is a place where they should be, they fit in. That's all. And so it's wonderful, you know, that sometimes there's people I thought would never make it as a monk, but they did. It's wonderful to have that openness. Give everyone a try. Equity. Even sick people. Even people with so-called mental diseases. Schizophrenia. Yeah, give it a try, see if it works. Isn't it beautiful that you can just have this openness? The relationship is more important than the thing. It's not just, you know, what the doctor said you have, it's just what you do with what you've got. Not better, not worse, not the same. And that's a beautiful thing about life, that I've never met anybody at all, anywhere like Ajahn Brahm, thank goodness. I don't want too many people like me telling all the bad jokes. What was a bad joke this week? I think I told that. Oh yeah, okay. This was told to me by the same fellow. You know, his job is to take me to the airport. I asked him, you better tell me a joke because your last joke about the Einstein joke, if you don't know that, you haven't been here for too long. So his joke was, he said, this fellow found a snail in his house. So you know the snails, they just leave all these slimy trails. So he opened the door, took up the snail, and threw the snail away in the garden. And 3 weeks later, no sorry, 3 months later, the snail was back. And the snail said to the guy, what did you do that for? It wasn't the best show, not as funny as the but there's, you know, if there's... I told you, there's no one like Ajahn Brahm who tells really bad jokes. But there was another guy. This was the guy who was a big businessman. Shouldn't really say who he was. But he was, I told him the story about the guy who went for an interview for a job. And he said, no, well, what's your qualifications? And he said, gave his qualifications. So we need someone who's a really responsible person. Can you show that you're a responsible person? He said, yeah, very easily. Just ring up my referees. Just the last five bosses I worked for, just give them a call and they will all confirm to you I'm a very responsible employee. When anything went wrong in the company, I was the one responsible. I'm a very responsible employee. Oh, that went down a bit better. But anyway, that's... You know, that's... So don't ever try to be something you're not. Be authentic. Don't try to be enlightened and just put on. This is what an enlightened monk should look like. Never smiling. Just like a robot. Horizontal mouth. Showing no emotions. That just really sucks. I don't know if I should say that, but anyway, I did. Because the real enlightened monks and nuns I saw, no one could really tell. They didn't fit the books, but they certainly, in their presence, you felt there's something really special there. Non-judgmental, accepting, kind, loving. Don't feel fear in their presence. And all the questions of the nature of the life were all answered in that relationship. Not demanding, not controlling. You know, because of that, that's one of the reasons why we meditate. Don't control your mind. Be kind to your mind. Look at your mind as a best friend. It's a relationship you have to your body and mind, which is more important than actually how your body is or how your mind is. It's not what you're meditating on, but it's how you're meditating. Are you trying to control it or be at peace with it? You understand that, you understand where the meaning of life is. It's not in the books. It's not even in you. It's in what's between us. Thank you for listening. Ah, come on, how long have I been away? You do sadhus, give it everything you've got. Okay, here we go again. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's the meaning of life. But enjoy and energy, whatever you have to do. Much more fun, and it's also healthy for you. More peaceful. Okay, have we got any questions here? I was told again in the car from the airport, I know that to get a question on that machine, you have to make up a weird name from a weird destination. So expecting a call from Mr. Trump from the White House, and it's just someone sitting in here. Okay, from Portugal, from UK, and from Romania. How do we know what our authentic self is since we are so conditioned by education and society? You've got no authentic self. Have an authentic relationship. Be true. Not to yourself, to what's between you and who you think you are. From the UK, I'm originally from South Africa, now living in the UK, a battle to make friends. How do I know I'm being true to myself? I'm on the right path. Because when you don't make friends, you accumulate friends. Don't make money. Money comes. Amazing thing, when you start searching for it, it runs away from you. You try and make friends, and then of course people just run away from you. So just be a friend. If you are a friend, in other words, you look at what's between you and the people, then of course friends happen. So don't be true to yourself, be true to us. You know that old saying, I said it so many times, I try to avoid it. In marriages, you look at the husband, look at the wife, and you say, it's not about you. It's not about her or him. Don't ever think about him anymore once you're married. Once you're married, you must never think of your partner. You must never think of yourself. You think of us. A marriage is about us. So, to see if you understand the question, the answer, whose problem is it in a marriage? Our problem. It's not his problem. It's not her problem. It's not my problem. It's our problem. Problem solved. From Romania, referring to goal setting and taking lower standard, how are we supposed to progress if we strive for mediocrity? Well, where's progress got us? Oh, I don't know, sometimes, well, those of you who know, oh, okay, maybe this might, oh, I'll say it anyway, I started. Where I was staying when I was in Bangkok was in Sukhumvit, now, if you know Sukhumvit Road, and the owners of the house, so they used to stay up in Sarton Road, you know, that's where the Australian Embassy used to be, that's moved now. And they said when they first looked at a piece of land over there, it took them 4 hours, give you some idea how far it is, 4 hours in an ox cart. And they said, this day it still takes them 4 hours in a traffic jam. Progress? So sometimes, are we really making progress in life? And sometimes the same old problems happen old times, new times, or that's one of the nice things about, if anyone does want to study some interesting parts of Buddhism, don't look at the suttas or the Abhidhamma, look at the Vinaya, the rules, but not just what the rules are, but where they came from. All about the bad things which monks and nuns did, the silly things they did. And there you find just human beings haven't changed for so many centuries. And, okay, here we go. This is my favorite. People think that, you know, that Buddhism is dull and boring. This is what happened. Please excuse me, the bhikkhunis, because this is one of the bhikkhunis' rules. In those days when they didn't have sanitation, sort of they had like the latrines, and it was one nun's job in the morning to get the buckets and put them in the proper place, you know, the cesspit or whatever it is, you know, to keep as healthy as possible. But one morning, this nun, she was a bit lazy, and it was early in the morning, no one around, so she took the bucket of, you know, number two, you know, feces, and she threw it over the wall. Early in the morning, no one around. But there is something which is also really one of the oldest laws in the universe, Murphy's Law. Even though the chances that there being someone on the other side of the wall were usually zero, it just so happened. At that moment, at that time, there was a gentleman who was really well dressed in his best clothes because he was going to the palace to see the king. And he was minding his own business, thinking about business, whatever it was, and a big bucket of shit fell on his head. Now, what would you do if that happened to you? Would you still be able to maintain your equanimity and kindness? He was really mad. He said, really angry. He said, look what happened to me. My best clothes, I'm about to go to the king to try and get some contract. Look what these people have done to me. Now, days before electricity, the streets would be lit by these little, not oil lamps, but it was like torches, like pieces of wood, you know, with some stuff which was had like tar or oil or something, which was lit so they could find the way. It's like a torch, a firebrand. So he grabbed one of those and he ran into the nuns' monastery. I'm going to burn the place down. That's what he thought. And he was really upset. And so when there was a gatekeeper there, really smart gatekeeper, and as soon as he saw this guy going to burn down the nuns' monastery, he said, what are you doing that for? Look what happened to me. Look, on my head, that came from the other side of the wall. That would be one of those nuns. And he looked at her and said, wow, that is so lucky. That is so auspicious. You've been blessed. I can't avoid this. You've been blessed with holy shit. He said, no, most people get water, but you got the real stuff from these amazing sacred nuns. And you know that sometimes some people, it's amazing what you can convince other people of. And this gatekeeper was obviously really, really good talker. Should have been a used car salesman. Because he convinced this guy. He said, listen, this is really fortunate, really lucky. So he said, you just go back home, get changed, get washed. And when you go back again, when you go back to the palace, I guarantee sure that you will get a really lucrative contract. And he believed it, and he went to the palace. He knew it worked. He got this really good contract, made his business a lot of money. You know what happened next? All the business people, they said, well, you know, if you really wanted to, you know where to go. You know, the economy of Western Australia is not doing that good, so if you really want a bit of luck in your business, you know where to go. Get the real stuff. And so as a result of that, once the Buddha heard about that, you know, because you know, word gets around, so okay, he had to lay down a new rule. number 8 of the Pajitiya rules for the nuns is that thou shalt not throw a bucket of shit over the monastery wall. It's there. Read it. I'll get it out for you later on, but it's there. So sometimes it's a wonderful sense of humour. How people don't change. Just, you know, an easy way, you know, sometimes gullible, believing all sorts of stuff, all rituals and rites, it'll make it sort of happy. Chinese New Year. I made people laugh when I was over in Singapore and also in Thailand. That I was just standing by the entrance door over there one Chinese New Year, just standing, minding my own business. I was talking to somebody over there, talking to this, I think this lady, I'm not quite sure, you know, which country she came from, but she was obviously Chinese and she couldn't speak any English, but she saw me sort of standing there. You know what she did? She took her hand and rubbed my tummy for good luck. She rubbed my own tummy. You're not supposed to do that. But anyway, I laughed. Anyway, never mind. Here we go. People don't change. But anyway, because it is Chinese New Year, the first day, Gongxi Fa Chai, if you come from, if you talk, is that Mandarin and Gongxi Fa Choi? For those who, that's actually Happy New Year. May you have a prosperous New Year. So anyway, so I think that's enough. So I'm supposed to be exhausted by coming back tonight, but somehow or other, just coming to see your friends again, people you know for a long time. It's nice to come back. So hope you enjoyed the talk this evening. So now we can do the bowing. Arahang Sama Sambuddha. And that's for my mum, dear old mum.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namah.